tumours all over its angular lines. Boarding worms were chewing their way inside. Guns fired wildly all over the battle barge. "We're losing Folodoc," said Erwin. His own ship shuddered as it unleashed yet another payload at the predators stalking it.
"They shall pay! We shall destroy them all!" replied Folodoc.
"We should withdraw."
"Negative!" said Folodoc. "I command you to hold ya!"
One of the Krakens crept sinisterly over the Essence Eternal, arm over arm. It wrapped its tentacles around the main Vox Tower. Folodoc's voice cut out as it wrenched the entire assembly free.
"He's lost," said Ackerman. "The chapter is lost," muttered Erwin. "Serval of response, open Vox channels to all surviving ships."
"Aye, my lord."
Erwin stood from his throne. The cables plugged into the back of his armor at least permitted him to do that.
"All vessels of the Angel's Excelsis."
As he spoke those words, another of his chapter's ancient craft was chewed up and eaten, then another.
"I, Erwin, assume command. I order all ships to turn about and rendezvous with..."
"Erwin, to port!"
shouted Ackerman in alarm. Erwin had time to look up and see the blunt exposed bone of a ramship's snout emerge from a swarm of vessels, swift and unexpected as an eel darting from its hole. The void shields burned away layers of the ram and sent purple lightning arcing all over the ship. It made not one iota of difference. The ramship impacted the splendid pinion's command tower several decks below the command deck. The violence of the impact threw Erwin off his feet. He slammed into the railing of his dais and flipped over it. The cables attaching him to the ship's power and command systems parted in a welter of sparks and smoke. He slammed into the lower deck, killing the servile he landed upon. For a moment, he lay dazed. The hiss of air from a breach in the hull roused him, the deadly sound standing out amid the cacophony of alarms, screams, and creaking metal. He stood with difficulty. His armor had no power supply. It was a dead weight on him, onerous to move without the assistance of its supplementary musculature.
"Servals!"
he barked. He coughed. His ribs were bruised by his fall. The air was foggy with smoke and fire-suppressant gas.
"Servals! Report!"
There was no reply. Someone was weeping, another groaning. At the last, unaltered humanity betrayed its weakness.
"Ackerman! Ackerman, where are you? Damn you, answer me!"
He staggered around the wreck of his command dais. The smell of Adeptus Astartes' blood drew him to Ackerman's final resting place. The sergeant lay sprawled under a girder, eyes bulging out of his broken skull.
"Serviles," he roared. "Report!"
There was still no reply. Thrashing electric cables spat arcing crackles. The glass of the oculus was queered by a massive crack running from the top to the bottom of the central pane. Much of the view was obscured by the sucking mouths of tyrannid beasts. Diamond teeth rasped on the glass, scratching it deeply. The command tower had buckled, and the oculus now pointed downwards towards the main hull. Through the diminishing gaps between the flocking beasts chewing on the glass, the dead bulk of the ramship was visible, its head thrust deep into the splendid pinion's innards. Among the orchestra of alarms, a fresh one began. Erwin's eye was drawn to a broken console. On a cracked picked screen, the rune for borders blinked urgently. Something began hammering on the command bridge door, something big. Erwin reached for his storm bolter, but it had been torn away from its strap. He struggled forwards towards the doors, drawing his combat knife. The command deck reverberated. 10 feet of plasteel was denting inward. Erwin took cover before the doors. The few Adeptus Astartes on the deck were all dead. The rest of his company was trapped in the decks below.
"Come on!" he screamed. "I will slay you!"
By the time the Carnifex hammered its way through the door, Erwin was fully in the Red Thirst's grip. He charged at the Tyranid in mindless fury. His mangled body hit the deck plates moments afterwards. Brilliant light from yet another reactor death seared the vision of the Blade of Vengeance's deck crew. A sphere of nuclear energy tore out a hole 12 miles across from the approaching Tyranid High Fleet. As suddenly as it was opened, it was filled again by the hurtling bodies of 10,000 Tyranid organisms, their tentacles already extending as if they could grab Baal from 500,000 miles away. "That was Erwin's ship," said Asante. "He died better than he lived." He consulted a TAC display. "The entire Angels Excelsis chapter is gone. We are losing ships too quickly. The force of the swarm is double what we expected." Bellerophon studied the tactical display. He could only agree.
"What do you propose, brother? That we turn and run?" said Bellerophon.
"No, my lord," said Asante. "We should begin phase 2 of the strategy."
"Not yet," barked Bellerophon. "We cannot split yet. We must slaughter as many of these Xenos filth as we can while we have the numbers. Our lives do not matter. I will spend them all if I thought it would help."
He lowered his voice.
"Only through sacrifice shall Baal stand."
The Space Marine fleet was bent back upon itself. 4 battle groups had become 1, a crescent line venting fire forward and to the sides. They could do little more than kill what they could. The Tyranids were too numerous to stop. Kill counters rattled up in a blur. Cogitation estimates had the number of Tyranid dead well into the millions. 307 hive ships had died to the Imperial guns. Bellerophon doubted they would ever get a good idea of how many lesser vessels had been blasted apart. Surely it would make sense for the enemy to stop, to turn about and retreat. No amount of feeding in the Baal system could possibly make up for the losses the Tyranids were enduring, and would surely endure when they landed upon Baal. Bellerophon was a gifted fleet commander, but he could not credit the hive mind with a strategic ability to force a passage north through Baal. It was idiocy. Why not avoid the Red Scar altogether? He also did not believe it intelligent enough to want the Blood Angels eliminated, or intelligent at all, in point of fact. And Mephiston's theory that the hive mind thirsted for vengeance, that was laughable. But what he could understand was that the Tyranids were numberless, and they were at Baal. Bellerophon understood defeat when he saw it. He chided himself. There was hope. The Sanguinor himself had said so. They could not hold the Tyranids, but they could slow them. Every dead beast was one that would not set foot on Baal. Every hive ship destroyed saw the hive mind's coherency weakened. They could do it. They must. Hope proved itself fleeting.
"My lord!"
The tone of the thrall's voice had Bellerophon reacting instantly.
"What? The augurs, my lord!"
Blood thralls were brave, loyal, not quite the best of the best, but head and shoulders above the common herd of men. The thralls who manned the command desk had been aspirants to the chapter who had failed by the narrowest of margins, but this one was scared.
"Look!"
He raised a quaking finger. Bellerophon turned his head to a minor hololith. The main display was occupied by the immediate environs of the battle, an area of 100,000 miles or so. The lesser hololith the thrall shakingly pointed to supported a graphical view of the entire system.
"By the blood of the great angel!" said Bellerophon.
From the far side of Baelor, a second hive fleet was approaching, bypassing the defenses and heading straight for Baal. There were tens of thousands more vessels, far too many to overcome, but he did not pause in making the order that would end his life. Bellerophon slammed his hand down on a button, opening every vox horn within hearing distance of his voice.
"All battle groups, pay heed!"
he shouted, his orders competing with the hideous white noise of Tyranid denial broadcasts.
"A second hive fleet approaches Baal!"
He keyed in a number of rapid orders into a nearby cogitator.
"Battle group Alpha, fall in line with a flagship. We cannot leave Baal undefended. The rest of you, cover our withdrawal until we are away, then break apart and make distance. I release you from my command. Pursue objectives of harassment and division as best you can. Keep as many of these Xenos fiends away from the Primarch's birthplace as you can, for as long as you can. By the blood were we made, my brothers. May the Emperor guide you and preserve you."
Dante did not see Bellerophon die. He did not see Asante die. He did not see the ancient blade of vengeance overwhelmed by Tyranid razor fields as it rushed into Baal's orbit. He did not see the Victus and the Bloodcaller forced to abort their attack and withdraw, heavily damaged. He did not see the miles-long flagship draw a blazing river of fire across Baal's upper atmosphere. He did not see it crash-land. Not until later would he see the column of black smoke that issued from the downed vessel. He did experience the violent tremor of the impact, though it originated hundreds of miles away. But as the steady green arrow of the Blade of Vengeance turned grey upon the hololith and fell from the representation of the sky, he felt the same burdensome regret he had felt every time a man had died under his command for over a millennium. He remembered Asante as a neophyte. He remembered Bellerophon's misery as his natural affinity for void war saw him permanently seconded to the Heavengate fleet, and been gladdened by his joy as he had grown into his role. He could not remember meeting either of them for the first time. There was a lot he did not recall. His memory was a vast hinterland, full of obscure countries shrouded in Lethean mists. Forgetting saddened him. It was a second death for those who had died, a further lessening of what they had been and who they were. "Bellerophon and Asante were heroes of this chapter," said Dante. "They will be honored." Silence greeted his words. There were many other heroes who had fallen in the past 5 days. The thunder of shocked air replied, loud enough to be heard through the redoubt's thick walls. The sound of thousands of tyrannocytes, ascetic spores and landing beasts falling into the atmosphere faster than the speed of sound. For the last half day, the defense lasers and larger cannons had been firing their infrequent reports and irregular heartbeat. Now thousands of smaller guns joined them. The Arx Angelicum trembled with rage. "Order the men to the walls," commanded Dante with an air of icy calm. "The enemy are at our gates. We shall repulse them." The invasion of Baal had begun. Chapter 17. Moat of Tears. The thick black streak of smoke on the horizon was a poor grave marker for so mighty a ship as the Blade of Vengeance. The sight of it stirred the wrath of Chaplain Ordermail to towering heights. Ordermail was stationed on the third line, overseeing some of the hordes of mortals drafted from the Baalian moons. The prefabricated sections of defense line they manned surrounded the curtain wall of the arcs like the teeth of a gargantuan man-trap. And it was a trap. There was a smooth area of sand 100 feet in front of the line. The sand appeared to be part of the desert, but was only a couple of inches thick, concealing a rock-crete channel 50 feet across that ran all the way around the arcs and its two walls. Inside the channel was thirst water. Ordermail had learned to fear thirst water when he was a boy. Nobody really knew what it was. Incariel said it was a vicious weapon from the long-ago war, although there were the possibilities that it was native to Baal Secundus, or a thing of Xenos origin. Thirst water looked like water, but it was alive, possessed of a rudimentary intelligence, and it hunted, lying in wait to lure the thirsty towards it. No refreshment was held in its liquid, only death, for it desiccated whatever it came into contact with, adding their moisture to itself. Its properties prevented proper study. However, the Blood Angels knew enough about it to find it, catch it, and to contain it. As much as could be found had been gathered on Baal Secundus. It would have escaped if it could, draining itself away into the sand, dividing into hundreds of separate organisms and flowing off to lurk. Dante had contaminated Baal with the system's deadliest substance. The chapter world would never be free of it. Desperate times led to unthinkable strategy. Even hidden under the sand, the thirst water affected the environment around it. It dried the air so much it crackled. Ordermail sensorium sensed something amiss and flagged up this unusual dryness. He was not completely safe in his battle plate. To approach the moat would have been death for the mortals fighting alongside the space marines, and so they were terrified. Ordermail strode among them as they lay cowering behind the defense lines, exhorting them to greater efforts, scaring them into taking up their guns and firing at the enemy. They could hardly hear him, though he bellowed with his voxmitter at full amplification. Many were startled as his massive armored black hand descended upon them unnoticed to pluck up discarded guns, child size in his grip, and gesturing for them to shoot.
In the name of the great angel, for the greater glory of the Emperor, for the preservation of Baal, keep firing! He roared. He brandished his Crozius Arcanum over his head. Tyranid microorganisms flashed to nothing in its disruption field. Keep them back! Keep them back from the moat! Baal had thrown off its desert silence and gave voice to Sanguinius's rage. All along the third and second lines, guns barked, while the Arx Angelicum hurled an endless barrage into the heavens, obliterating hive ships and their effusions of landing craft. But there were always more, no matter how many were rent to pieces by shrapnel or energy blast. A wall of furious noise thundered behind Ordermail. From the reconstructed curtain wall, thousands of heavy weapons banged and howled, sending out such a quantity of plasma and lasfire, the environment around the Arx Angelicum stirred with unnatural heat. The mortal men on the defense line shone with sweat. Missiles rushed overhead. Sand erupted in drifting fountains in a display to shame a potentate's gardens. Autocannons blasted long lines of puffed sand. Heavy shells blew up geysered plumes. The audio dampers of Ordermail's box beads strained against the thundering of the Arx Angelicum's main guns. Defense lasers spat out columns of blinding light that tortured the air into storm fronts. Macro cannons intended to sweep the void free of enemy ships were turned to face the earth, and the wounds they inflicted were huge. The tremors from their impacts shook Ordermail in his armor. The very air shouted. Such was the atmospheric disturbance caused by the Arx Angelicum's outpouring of fire that the sky was charged with energy. Lightning storms blasted all around the fortress monastery, and static crackled over Ordermail's battle plate. Burning debris drew black lines from the sky. Metal and meat showered down for 500 miles around the Arx from the continuing void war. The remnants of the fleets performed lightning raids and surgical thrusts into the swarm where they could, their weapons sheeting out the sky with white actinic flashes. Cosmic thunders rolled around the horizon. An avalanche of biomunitions hurtled at the fortress from space. All were annihilated. The very skin of reality quivered as missiles and creatures were destroyed by the void shield, shunted by its arcane technology into the warp. And yet, the sound of guns was not the loudest noise. The swarm's voice suppressed it all. A sinister susurrus of hissing and the click of chitinous plate on plate, punctuated by the pained shrieks of discharging bioweapons. The sound was weirdly reminiscent of strong wind in trees. Were those trees full of predatory desire, and the wind a horrific scream? The Tyranids were an adaptive race, but their invasion pattern never changed, having been honed by millions of planetary attacks to unimprovable perfection. First came the release of billions of airborne microbes that went to war with the world's unseen biome of bacteria, viruses, and microscopic creatures. Some of this organic soup was designed to foul weapons or destroy mechanisms. Most of it initiated the consumption of the world even as it fought to survive. Macro-scaled explosive spores followed by the million, throwing out more microspores along with their scything bursts of shrapnel when they detonated, making flight perilous for the defenders and disrupting ground formations. Then came the aerial swarms, winged horrors of all sizes, some deployed directly from orbit, others leaping from burning drop cysts as they plunged thoughtlessly to their destruction. Only when the skies were full to bursting with their own kind did the Tyranids begin their ground assault, dropping hundreds of thousands of assault spores around primary military targets. The lesser types fell at killing speed, splashing open like rotting fruit, sending out a seed of swift monsters who gathered together in great hordes and attacked anything they could find. The smaller constructs came down first. Always. Keep them back from the moat!
Yelled Ordermail. As yet, the Tyranids were disorganized. Their larger leader beasts had not come down in any number, and as soon as they were spotted, they were targeted and destroyed by fire on the walls. Thousands of gaunts attacked in ragged waves, pounding towards the defense line in mass, uncoordinated assaults. It was distraction behavior, meant to tie down defenders with uncountable numbers while the greater strains landed. Back from the front, a thick rain of tyrannocytes landed hordes of these bigger bioconstructs. chitinous air brakes, deployed at the last moment, slowed their descent enough to protect their cargo. The pods themselves burst on impact, throwing out sprays of thick mucus. Creatures poured from the dying innards, dripping with shock-absorbing liquids to join the waves advancing on the defense line that formed the outer perimeter of the Ark's Angelicum. The Space Marines had seen it 1,000 times. They swept the creatures away with small arms fire, while their big guns remained firmly targeted upon the falling spores. The larger the spores were, the more fire they attracted. There was an added complication to the battle. It was imperative the probing attacks not be allowed to come into contact with a moat. Dante kept most of the Space Marines behind the curtain wall. The unarmored mortals baited the trap, watched over by a handful of veterans and chaplains. Ordermail pitied the chapter master. It was not in his nature to be so cavalier with the lives of common humanity. This war cost him part of his soul.
"Keep firing! The Emperor is watching you!" roared Ordermail. "He judges you! He condemns anyone who will not fight!"
The men and women of the moons struggled under Baal's heavier gravity. Their movements were sluggish, but though impeded, they gave good account of themselves. The moons were violent worlds. Most of them could fight.
"Destroy them! Destroy them! Permit not the alien to live!" he shouted.
Chaplains of 10 chapters prowled the deadly ground before the curtain wall. Their armor was all black and bone. They could have been of the same brotherhood. They were in the most important respects. The bonds of the bone and the blood united sanguinary priests and chaplains across the chapters of the blood, regardless of all other considerations. To the mortals, they were the personification of death itself, giants in grimacing helmets, whose words could fell the most deadly of foes. Ordermail urged the humans to fight in the name of a god he did not see as divine, shouting prayers meant only for the ears of battle brothers, all while judging the situation and reacting to the chatter of orders sounding in his ears. It was crucial the gaunt hordes were kept back until they were ready to launch a major attack. If the Space Marines lost the element of surprise, they would lose the vital kill count the First Water could deliver.
"By the purity of the chosen tribes have you survived to this day!" shouted Ordermail. "You are of the blood! Give your thanks in righteous violence! Destroy those that would consume you!"
A cartolith interposed itself between his eyes and the outside world. The Tyranids were represented as a thick red stain around the Ark's Angelicum. Patterns were emerging where before had been confusion. More of the larger beasts were coming down, exerting the conscious control of the hive mind over the gaunt's limited instincts. Exploratory fingers groped for weak points, whereupon they would be gathered together into a fist. Soon the Tyranids would attack, and all at once. They had the numbers. They did not care for individual death. Rushing the prey from all sides prevented it from concentrating its fire. There was a horrible perfection to the foe, but perfection was limited in expression. The Tyranid's success had made them predictable.
"Chaplains, prepare!"
Dante's calm, pure voice rang in Ordermail's box beads. "Critical mass in gaunt hordes predicted in 400 seconds. A counter imposed from outside ticked down over Ordermail's left eye. Rippled ruby lasfire snapped out from the defense line. Gaunts screeched and tumbled to a dead stop, limbs tangled up.
"The great angel's home is at risk. You were at risk, and the great angel said, 'Let not the hunger of the alien be sated upon human flesh.' Do not demean his words. Destroy! Destroy! Destroy!"
Ordermail spotted a straggling group of gaunts racing close to the lip of the moat.
"Sector 9-5 Gamma," he said quickly into his box. "Possible breakthrough. Neutralize."
He sent the location to Central Command. The gaunts were within yards of the moat when a storm of heavy lasfire crashed down from the Ark's Angelicum and cut them to pieces. Shrapnel pattered down over the defense line. The mortals there threw themselves flat. A few looked fearfully behind them, turned, and fled.
"Stand your ground!"
Ordermail shouted, striding among them. He swatted a man with his Crozius, destroying his ribcage. Blood sprayed across the sand. Another fell to a single shot of his bolt pistol.
"Return to the fray!"
If Ordermail must act as a common commissar, then he would. The duty was unpleasant, but not dishonorable. A few of his brothers in the black were more enthusiastic in their efforts. The smell of blood stirred something inhuman in him. He shepherded the weeping fugitives back to the wall and returned his eyes to the enemy.
"Stand by all defense line sectors," Adonisio spoke this time. "Incoming heavy bombardment on my mark. Be ready. We provoke an attack, targeting hive node creatures."
Out beyond the moat, arriving leader beasts exerted their influence, and the hordes of gaunts were becoming more organized. They formed into solid ranks that were moving as one towards the perimeter, ignoring the massive casualties they sustained. Thousands fell to the Imperial guns. Their bodies were piling into a berm of shattered chitin and pulped flesh that the weight of the horde bulldozed forward towards the perimeter. All the while, mycetic spores screamed down from orbit to disgorge yet more tyrannids. In the distance, the dripping shapes of larger and larger beasts were rising from their broken transports. The greatest command beasts, heavy assault constructs, and brood mothers emerging behind the first expendable wave. Soon, living artillery would set down, and the battle would commence in earnest. So many worlds were overwhelmed by this initial horde. Not Baal.
"Bombardment commencing. 3, 2, 1, mark."
The guns cut out for a brief moment. A second later, a rippling wall of coordinated explosions arose from the sand. Tyrannid bodies flew upward, shattered into fragments, riding sheets of dust and fire into the air. The leaders were targeted. Giant hive tyrants were cut down where they stood. Massive flying crones were downed by anti-aircraft fire. Warrior broods were obliterated in roiling storms of plasma that burned the faces of the mortals exposed to them.
"Witness the fury of the Blood Angels!" roared Ordemail,
staring full into the inferno.
"Witness your salvation!"
A second massive bombardment blasted the Xenos, this one a few hundred yards back from the first. Two concentric rings were briefly cut into the horde. The bombardment ceased, and the guns resumed firing at targets of opportunity. The gaunts roared and hissed as loudly as a tempestuous sea. Their leader beasts fell at the moment of attack. Their behavior changed again. What had been a flock-like movement once more became individualistic, chaotic. Fights broke out between the creatures in places. They rocked forward suddenly as the gaps in their lines were filled in by onrushing beasts, knocking those at the fore towards the moat. It was important that the horde's own impetus could not be halted. Timing was everything. They must be goaded.
"Stand ready,"
voxed Adonisio. All down the line, chaplains turned to face the horde. Ordemail continued his commands to fire. The gaunts halted a few yards from the edge of the moat. Their blood was seeping towards the thirst water. As soon as moisture touched it, it would be revealed. The gaunts' native instincts would demand they halt to await further direction.
"My lords," he voxed, "it must be now."
"Withdraw,"
said Adonisio.
"Warriors of the Imperium," roared Ordemail, "back to the wall."
Similar commands issued from 100 skull-masked faces. Malnourished faces looked up at Ordemail in a moment of bewilderment.
"But they're stopping," said one.
"We're winning."
Ordemail strode towards the wretch, picked him up by his clothes, and tossed him towards the curtain wall as easily as if he were a rag.
"Back!"
he shouted.
"Back!"
The men and women of Baal needed no more encouragement. They turned and fled, many throwing down their weapons. They staggered under the heavier gravity, fleeing like dreamers in a nightmare, unable to outpace their pursuers. The shouts as they ran were lost to the thunder of war. The gaunts did not follow. They ceased their milling. A ripple of movement passed down the front rank as they turned to face the wall. Order returned to their ranks.
"Strategium! Something is wrong!"
voxed Ordemail.
"They do not pursue!"
The first gaunts had reached within feet of the moat. Their ranks were so tightly packed it was hard to tell individual creatures apart. In the distance, hulking monsters screeched and roared, raging without proper direction. That would not last. More leader strains were inbound. They did not have much time.
"They're not taking the bait," said Ordemail.
He pushed his way through the humans, struggling away from the defense line, and stepped over the metal.
"Xenos," he shouted. "I am Ordemail, Paternus Sanguis of the Blood Angels, second only to beloved Astoreth the Grim. fight me. By the blood, come to my Crozius and accept my blessing.
The monsters were barely 300 feet away. They stood motionless, unblinking, their hooves ploughing up the sand as the weight of the Tyranid swarm at their back pressed them forward. The bright slick of Xenos blood was rolling towards the concealed moat. A solitary gaunt watched the slow spread of this sticky river suspiciously, and then it looked up at Ordermail. Ordermail had stared into the dead-black eyes of countless gaunts. This one was different. There were subtle variations to its cranium, a difference in the way its heat vents were arranged, small but crucial. Something rode this creature, something so ancient and powerful that at 100 yards away, looking out from one of 1,000 near-identical beasts, its presence pressed at the chaplain and made him reel. Ordermail stared into the face of the hive mind. How it looked out from this simple beast, he did not know. All he knew was that it must be killed. It could not cow him. He was a space marine, a blood angel. Ordermail knew no fear. He raised his gun. A single shot obliterated the mutant skull of the gaunt. The horde froze a second, then broke forward. The death of the gaunt was the pebble taken from the dam. The gaunts fell forward in screeching thousands, pushed on by their need to kill and the weight of thousands more behind them. It was uncanny to see the change from total organization. Simple instincts intended to make them effective should the hive mind be disrupted worked against them. The blood slick trickled into the moat and sank through the sand. A soft crackling sounded as it came into contact with a thirst water. It was a warning any son of Baal Secundus knew well. It did not halt the Tyranids. Ordermail threw up his arms and turned his skull helm to face Baal Secundus, looming beyond the whirling aerial swarms.
By his blood did he make me, shouted Ordermail. I am an angel of Sanguinius.
The first gaunts plunged through the scrim of sand, obscuring the first water, their screeches lost instantly as hundreds of their fellows plunged down on top of them. They piled on into the first water without stopping. All around the Arx Angelicum, driven on by the unrestrained desire to kill, they tumbled into the rock-creek channel where they thrashed and screamed and died. The bleached bones and exoskeleton plates of the creatures emerged as bright reefs from the surface, only to slip back under as every vestige of moisture was sucked from them and they were reduced to powder. The death toll was incalculable. How many hundreds of thousands, Ordermail could not tell, but they kept on coming and coming. As the remains clogged the moat, it allowed the aliens to come closer, but still half the width remained unfilled, and the gaunts continued to fall mindlessly into it, screeching hatefully as they died. All of a sudden, it stopped. The swarm halted dead in its tracks. Hundreds more were murdered by impetus, and then the slaughter was done. The rest fell back from the brink. The first water slopped and churned in its narrow prison, eager for more. Larger beasts moved forward to impose the hive mind's will. The gaunts steadied, only to scatter again as the greater beasts were shot down by weapons on the curtain wall. More leader beasts came to die, then more. Back and forth the gaunt horde went, never quite making it to the edge of the moat. Their numbers thinned all the while by a constant rain of giant shells and making fire from the defences. The slaughter went on for half an hour. The air grew hot with weapons discharge. The smell of physoline and scalding metal overpowered the stink of spilt alien blood. No more larger beasts came. The gaunts drew back one final time, turned tail, and scurried from the moat. Unbelievably, the Tyranids were withdrawing. Cheers and song erupted all along the curtain wall, followed by a redoublement of firing into the backs of the fleeing creatures. Ordermail at the head of his Crozius thumped to the floor and knelt in thankfulness.
By the blood, are we made victorious, he said.
Chapter 18. Darkest Hour. The tremors of battle penetrated every part of the fortress monastery, shaking even the hidden walls of the Librarius, whose walls were not all of Cretes and stone, and whose ways did not necessarily lead to places on Baal. Rasselas sat impatiently within the chemic spheres, watching an entranced Mephiston for signs of life. Mephiston had not moved for days. His face was grey, his skin contrasting queasily with his mane of white hair. He looked like a corpse. Rosellus wished he were performing the vigil alone. Unfortunately, Mephiston had insisted Lucius Antros attend with him.
"He has been gone a long time," said Antros.
Antros's voice was a croak. Antros was inhumanly beautiful, a paragon of Sanguinius's form to Rosellus's pugilist's body, but his beauty was marred. His sculpturally sharp features were drawn, dark shadows pouched his eyes. The librarians of Baal suffered the ill effects of proximity to the hive mind. Lesser beings than they would have been driven insane. Rosellus could not help but think that the strain had peeled back Antros's beauty to reveal something of his true nature.
"He should have returned to us by now," said Antros plaintively.
Rosellus ran his gauntlet over his close-cropped silver hair. He was very old, but it was rare for him to feel his age like he did then. A billion voices hissed at the edge of his hearing. The mental pressure did nothing good for his humor. His limbs were like lead, heavy in their metal casings. They had been armored since the invasion began. He had taken no solid sustenance nor liquid while in the chemic spheres, relying on his battle plate's nutrient fluids, and his mouth was gummy from underuse. His skin was intolerably grimy under his body glove. Every microscopic grain of salt from his dried sweat was a rough pebble grating on his flesh, each as irritating to him as Antros was.
"It will take as long as it will take, Lexicanium," said Rosellus, pronouncing each word with acid calm.
He closed his ever-glowing eyes. It was tempting never to open them again. Antros was fretful, behaving in a way unbecoming for an angel of the blood, his hands twisted in his lap, ceramite grating on ceramite.
"It is wrong to be in here. We should be out there with the others. They need our strength. Our gifts will be missed in the fight."
Rosellus almost shouted at Mephiston's protege, but bit back his anger at the last.
"One cannot dictate to the Lord of Death," he said through gritted teeth. "You can only do what he asks and hope it works in your favor in the end. If we do not act to head off this other peril, we will have two enemies to face, and then three as we turn upon ourselves. We are needed here. We stay here."
Admitting it aloud would have killed Rosellus, but Antros had a point. More than half of the Blood Angels librarians present on Baal, and a score from other chapters, waited for word from the chief librarian. That was a lot of destructive potential sitting on its hands. Isolated in the chemic spheres, Rosellus had little idea how the battle fared, but the guns had not rested once, and kept up a steady rhythm, firing enough times to shatter a war fleet. He could tell when the Tyranids landed. The shake of every discharge was now followed moments later by a fainter impact tremor, a sign of guns firing at targets on the ground.
"He will come back to us when it is time."
Rosellus doubted the words as he said them. Mephiston had been in a trance for too long. The longer Mephiston was under, the more concerned Rosellus became. Mephiston walked the warp at the worst possible time.
"By the angel's wings, Mephiston, where are you?"
he said. The Lord of Death said nothing. Hours crawled by. Another day passed. The endless pounding of the guns merged with a thump of Rosellus's headache. Once he tried to enter a trance himself to see if he could locate Mephiston's astral form, but he was stymied. Mephiston was a master at spiritual projection, a skill few space marine librarians had to any degree, and that was yet another thing that set Mephiston apart from his fellows. Rosellus lacked his master's ability, and the crushing malice of the Tyranid's composite soul shut all doors to the epistolary. His attempts exhausted him. His warp-blasted eyes slid shut. He meant to meditate. Instead, he slept. He awoke to a gentle shaking of his shoulder guard.
"Rouse yourself! Now is the time, Rosellus!"
Mephiston stood over him, his skin still drawn and grey. He was a revenant, haunting Rosellus in the night. Rosellus blinked and swallowed in an unsuccessful attempt to moisten his dry mouth.
"Mephiston? My lord? I have returned. We must go. Now."
Antros was already standing. Their thrones had vanished. Rasselas got groggily to his feet, and his own seat dissolved into a mist of blood-red corpuscent. Mephiston made a series of gestures, and the flesh-like dome wall of the chemic spheres parted. Their isolation was over. Rasselas's vox-beads came alive with the steely, calm battle chatter of space marines at war. "Prepare our Thunderhawks!" Mephiston's sepulchral voice cut into the vox like a knife. "We leave! Now!" Two gunships, packed with librarians and a small bodyguard of veteran space marines, flew out from the Arx Angelicum. The gunships were yet more assets that should have been utilized against the Xenos. Rasselas patched his helmplate display into the auger eyes of the craft, and watched as the ships ascended at a steep angle and flew quickly over the excavated landing fields around the fortress monastery. Vast networks of spidered cracks were eroded into the ancient rockcrete. If he had not known them for what they were, it would have been easy to think the fields a natural formation on the ground. But from the air, their artificial origin was obvious, and the footings of long-vanished buildings were clear as day in the sand between the numerous landing aprons that had known no thruster's kiss since the beginning of history. The extent of the extramural facilities were a tragic indication of how large the Blood Angels had once been. Not even all the sons of Sanguinius gathered together in this one place again matched the full size of their parent legion. Another reminder, if Rasselas needed one, that they lived in diminished times. The Thunderhawks followed the curve of the void shield down. Rasselas swayed in his maglocked boots as his mass shifted. They passed over formations of space marines moving to reinforce various points of the wall. Tank formations and whole phalanxes of jump-pack-equipped assault marines waited behind the wall to deal with breakthroughs. A sense of unfettered rage took him as they flew over a newly built hangar of plasteel. The psychic mark of the Death Company was unmistakable to Rasselas, and awesome in its might. They flew between stabbing beams of energy, jinking to avoid the track of shells. The craft wobbled in munition-shocked air as they sped over the curtain wall and on past the killing zone between the wall and the third line. In the open space, funeral pyres of neatly stacked mortal corpses sent up thick black smoke. The numbers of mortals manning the defense barriers seemed thin. Long-ranged weapons fired from the two lines. The defenders' small arms were silent. The Tyranids had ceased pressing their assault. The reasons became clearer once the gunships decelerated to pass through the void shield. Hundreds of thousands of Tyranid corpses lay around the outermost defenses, the piles of them growing in height and density until they were heaped as tall as a dreadnought around the moat. The layer of camouflaging sand and oil had been disturbed, and the moat was now revealed for most of its circuit. The bleached, desiccated remains of Tyranids half filled it. "A respite! Nothing more," said Mephiston, as always seemingly privy to Rasselas's inner thoughts. "The hive mind will be formulating a new strategy." Sporadic fire rained down on the luckless mortals. Their position was outside the void shield and therefore exposed to both the enemy's artillery and its airborne contingent. But the Arx Angelicum's mightiest void ship killing weapons suppressed most of the Tyranids' heavy gun beasts, and the few winged aliens daring to stoop upon the mortals were mostly shot down before they could finish their attack runs. Rasselas tensed. Outside the shield, the gunships were at risk.
"Where are the aerial swarms?" he said. "They will be on us when we're out of range of the wall's anti-aircraft emplacements," said Mephiston.
The Lord of Death was rarely wrong. They headed away from the fortress monastery, flying hard for the south. The ring of churned-up desert and dead Xenos gave way to a sea of creatures of every size, from those no bigger than vermin to examples as large as battle tanks. There was not a scrap of sand visible through their multitudes, and though shells screamed down into them, blasting hundreds to pieces with every hit, the holes filled rapidly.
"It is no more use than throwing stones into the ocean," growled Rasselas. "We have other problems," said Antros, his eyes closed in a light trance. "They are coming for us."
The pilot's voice bore out Antros's predictions.
"Be warned, my lords, the aerial swarms approach, initiating evasive maneuvers."
The Thunderhawk's engines screamed up to maximum power, jolting Rasselas in his armor. He switched views between the external lenses of the ship until he caught sight of flocks of black shapes swirling like sentient smoke towards them from the east. They were a replication of the cosmic swarms reaching for individual worlds. The Tyranids were fractal in organization, their hierarchy and their movements repeated at every scale. The view grew uncertain. Residue accumulated on the auger lenses. The engines coughed as Tyranid microorganisms clogged the intakes. The aerial swarms switched and moved as one. In their precise choreography, it was easy to see them as one creature, not many. The ship outpaced the eastern swarm with ease, but others appeared to the south, spreading like an opening hand to catch them. The horizon grew black over the mountains where the Thunderhawks were heading, until the sky was a thick, swirling mass of winged bodies. The Thunderhawks' weapons opened fire. Their armament was pitifully inadequate to take on so many beasts. "My lord," boxed the pilot, "we will have to turn back. We cannot pass this swarm. It is a wall in the sky."
"Hold your course," stated Mephiston, "and open the rear ramp."
Alarms clanged through the passenger cabin as the rear-facing assault ramp dropped down, forming a slope that ended as a black line against the faded red of the desert.
"I shall return in a few moments, brothers," said Mephiston.
There were warriors from other chapters within the Thunderhawk who had never seen Mephiston in action. Rasselas grinned at their reaction as Mephiston unlocked his boots from the floor and strode towards oblivion. Empiric energy coursed through the transport hold, Mephiston its focus. With a crackling snap, wings of ruby energy unfurled from his back, and Mephiston leapt into the air without breaking his stride, drawing the sword Vitaris as he took flight.
"He really will return in a few moments," said Rasselas.
He focused his attention once more on the feed from the Thunderhawk's external sensors. Propelled by the limitless power of the warp, Mephiston streaked past the gunships. A storm of red energy built in front of him, trailing streamers of gases chilled out of the atmosphere. The Lord of Death held out Vitaris before him, his ethereal wings beating with firm, steady strokes out of time with the great speed he was travelling. A wordless, psychic shout roared from Mephiston's powerful mind, and the storm around him expanded to a broad globe, shaking the Thunderhawks. Writhing energies passed through their airframes and sparked from the Psyker's armor within. The Lord of Death's power concerned Rasselas. He spent his quiet hours wondering if the being he called a master and friend truly was on the side of the angels. The storm stabilized, making a barrier around the Thunderhawks. It flickered with eruptions of pink and red lightning that grew fiercer as the aerial swarm approached. The Tyranids would attempt to slow or stop them, if they could not destroy the Thunderhawks outright, until the pursuing swarms caught them up, and their heavier, slower flying beasts could be brought into play. Then the librarians would be finished. Such a tactic had probably worked a million times on a million devoured worlds, but there was only one Mephiston, and the hive mind had yet to experience the full potency of his wrath. Rasselas let his empirical senses brush Mephiston's mind briefly, for to push deeper invited death at the chief librarian's own hand. The chill, cold fury of Mephiston's rage outmatched the hunger of the hive mind. Rasselas thought it could dull the light of the Astronomicon itself. The warp heaved around them. The hive mind's vastness had calmed it to doldrums. Mephiston stirred it into a psychic hurricane. The Tyranids shrieked as they neared their prey. Weapon symbiotes extended from aerodynamic housings. Claws flexed in anticipation of a kill. Maws glowed with building bioplasmic generation. Into the swarm the globe of energy went. The skies flashed for 100 miles around with unnatural auroras. The Tyranids disappeared as Mephiston's wrath consumed them. Most of those present knew this ability as the Blood Lance, but none of them could wield it as Mephiston did. A tremendous electric roar shook the craft as the storm bored a hole right through the Tyranid swarm. Greasy ash thumped against the ships. The librarians moaned as they fought to keep hold of their souls while immersed in the ambit of Mephiston's overwhelming power. The Thunderhawk bucked, and they were through. On the ship's view, Rasselas saw clear sky ahead. The storm winked out, Mephiston turned back towards the ship. His wings were fading and shrinking in on themselves. All psychers had limits. Mephiston, strong though he was, had reached his. The ship shook with engine exertion, blurring Rosellus's vision. He unlocked his boots, leaned forward against the acceleration, and headed for the ramp.
"Somebody help me!"
he called against the howling engine noise. Antros came down first, then a codicier of the Red Knights, and a lexicanium of the Blood Legion.
"He will return in a moment,"
Rosellus shouted, relying on vox and augmeter amplification to convey his words.
"Do not let him fall!"
The swarm was receding behind them, its constituent parts wheeling around in the sky to pursue the escaping space marines. Rosellus locked his boots to the ramp only at the very edge. He scanned the empty skies.
"Where is he?"
shouted Antros. A bang on the ramp answered his question. An armored hand appeared. Mephiston clawed his way up. Detaris rang on the metal. Rosellus trapped the blade with his foot to prevent it falling from the gunship. Mephiston could rise no further. His eyes glowed red in his pallid face. His teeth were bared, his canines fully extended. Rosellus knelt and grabbed Mephiston's arm.
"Someone take the sword and help me drag him in," he called.
The others pulled at the chief librarian. He was unable to move, and a dead weight in his armor that taxed their strength. But they hauled him aboard.
"Shut the ramp," commanded Rosellus.
Pistons drew the exit shut. The roaring of the engines and rush of air was sealed away from their ears. A second mind made itself known to Rosellus, as ravening as the red first, yet coldly calculating. In the fraction of a second of contact, the similarities with Mephiston's soul were striking. A creature of immense power, possessed of a hunger that could never be sated. A flare of power shoved away the alien presence. Mephiston lifted his head. Blood ran from his eyes.
"Fly faster!"
he snarled at Rosellus. Hearing their lord, the pilots pushed their engines to their limits, and the Thunderhawks sped onward to the Kruor Mountains, leaving the aerial swarm laboring far behind. Chapter 19. Lord of Blood. A spray of bolts finished the gaunt mid-leap. The quarry cliffs echoed to the detonations long after the thing's broken shell crunched upon the rock. The Thunderhawks were already away, racing fast from the gaining aerial swarms. Out from the Arx Angelicum, the Tyranid presence was minimal. There was not much on Baal, other than the Space Marines, but small groups had evidently been dispatched to deal with places like the Bloodstone Quarry. Servitors lay dead where they'd fallen, their loads of stone and tools spilled. These had no combat protocols, and they had been slaughtered while they were working. Rosellus trudged up a low fan of angular machined rock, grimacing when he spied a small Tyranid organism nosing through the innards of a dead cyborg. He killed the creature with a casual twitch of his mind, and towed the remains of the servitor with his boot. The remains lay in a sticky pool of mixed blood and oil. Its metal torso casing had been melted through by acid spray, the organics inside part consumed. The dead cyborg looked up at Rosellus with open, dull eyes. They never seemed more human than in death. Such pity stirred in the epistolary that he bent close the thing's eyelids with his hand. Another series of bolt shots rang out. Rosellus looked down to the wide open space in front of the mine gates. Space Marine librarians swept the area clear. They relied on their weapons in the main, conserving their psychic might for the coming ritual. At that moment, they were the galaxy's most overpowered combat patrol, he thought. The mine's machinery was untouched. The Tyranids had no interest in it, and saw no threat from it, so the conveyors, rock crushers, earth shifters, and more stood ready for service. Only the servitors were dead, and they had been comprehensively exterminated. The mine was completely autonomous and had gone into lockdown as soon as the Xenos attacked. Its armored gates were closed fast against the alien hordes. The outer part had been an open-cast facility. With its load of bloodstone worked out millennia ago, the servitors had followed the veins of crystal into the mountain. The Kruor Mountains were the sole source anywhere for bloodstones, with which the Blood Angels and certain favored successors adorned their armor. They were of immense importance to the chapter, for the stones held ritual and spiritual meaning that few outsiders were allowed to know of. Square-cut machine cliffs surrounded the central pit. To the south, a road for automated haulers led up to the surface. The Cruor Mountains rose, flat peaks to the southeast, south, and west. The quarry was enormous, a pit, but it was a mean atrium to the vast mine workings hidden under the ground. Rosellus sniffed the air. Powdered rock, spilt oil and thin cyborg blood, the aseptic scent of Tyranid Vitae, wholly unpalatable, and the moistureless expanse of Baal's global desert.
"A good a place for a last stand as any," he muttered bleakly. "It is this way."
Mephiston was leaning on Antros, pointing to a path that led up from the quarry through interleaved piles of tailings away from the main mine entrance. The Lord of Death's voice was a whisper in Rosellus's voxbead. He wondered how many times the Lord of Death could stretch himself like this and survive. Each major expenditure of effort in this crisis wore him down a little more. His strength had yet to return from his battle in the sky, and he leaned heavily on Lucius Antros. Rosellus was disturbed at the sight. He did not trust the younger librarian entirely. Antros was too eager for power. There was something unseemly in the way he fussed over the chief librarian. He had known people like that in Kemrender, back before his apotheosis. The ambitious were always drawn to the strong. Mephiston was a distant, strange, isolated figure. He remembered Calistarius, the man Mephiston had been. Sometimes he thought he could see bits of his old brother in the Lord of Death, but he could not speak out to Mephiston in honesty, like he could have done with Calistarius. No one could. The words could be said, but Mephiston was so immured in his own strange state, they were not heard. Rosellus had asked the priest Albinus to speak with him. He was arguably his only other friend, but Mephiston had shut Albinus out at the mere suggestion that Antros's power was growing too quickly. Rosellus rebuked himself. These thoughts would not do. Antros was of the Librarius. Mephiston judged him worthy, so should he. He was getting intolerant in his old age. Antros was the same as any psyker. They were all strange. It was in their nature. He forgot sometimes that he was no different to his brothers.
"My eyes glow all the damn time, and I'm charmlessly misanthropic," he scolded himself.
He went to join the others. The path led them through heaps of crushed spoil to the side of the mountain. A small portal of thick plasteel barred the way within. Mephiston withdrew a signum key from his belt and bid the lock machine spirit open.
"Obeying,"
sighed the door, with a voice as worn and empty as the desert. The door clunked into its housing. Mephiston went in first. Rosellus beckoned the rest after, his gaze ever on the skies. They went into a wide corridor, carved from the bones of Baal. Rosellus felt something down there. He had read widely, and spoken with psychers of many kinds. He recalled the idea of the world spirit, a confusing Eldar concept that seemed to apply both to their artificial pseudo-organic informational networks and to the native animus of a world. Everything the Eldar believed was offensive to the human mind, possessed of diametrically opposed duality that made a nonsense of their philosophies. Sometimes, though, Rosellus thought there might be something to what they said. Their understanding of the warp was dangerously flawed, but even so, there was a field to places. Rosellus had been witness to many strange things that the teachings of the Librarius poorly explained. Baal's spirit, then, if that was what he felt, it was huge and immobile, an ossified thing with little life but great presence, like a towering mesa of dry stone. In the dim past, unusual tunnels had been uncovered by the giant grinding machines of the Imperium at the ends of these workings. The passage ended abruptly. Concentric marks of a machine drill's teeth forever marked the spot where the Blood Angel's servants had broken through into the labyrinth. The machines the Blood Angels employed plundered the stone with little regard for the mountains, making tunnels that were straight and broad, and obliterated everything in the process. The passages beyond were surgical, a confusion of intersecting galleries as delicate as a circulatory system, precisely following a single seam of bloodstone. There was a suggestion that these older workings were contemporaneous with the Carceri Arcanum. Perhaps they were not made by human hand. They were certainly oddly proportioned, being wide and low. Mysterious as they were, the tunnels were unimportant. Where they led was. The tunnels went far into Baal, abruptly terminating at one spectacular cave that not even the Imperium had the heart to pillage. This sacred place, the Ruberica, or the heart of Baal, was the librarian's destination. A bloodstone blood drip was a mark of honor of a space marine's kinship with Sanguinius. Several variations were awarded for notable deeds on and off the battlefield, including mastery of the five virtues and the five graces. The jewels were not only symbolic, each one was also mildly psychically resonant. Individually, the stones were too small to have any effect on the bearer, but where there was a large amount of the crystal, they amplified psychic power. The warpitch in Rasselis's eyes intensified. The light they emitted burned brighter. His limbs felt stronger, his mind sharper. The auras of his companions became bright enough to see in the mortal realm and struck glimmers of reflected empirical power from the walls of the caves. Gradually, the pressure of the shadow in the warp slipped away, taking Rasselis's headache with it. He breathed easily for the first time in days. Mephiston also drew strength from the sight, effecting a remarkable recovery. Early on, he shook off Antros's helping arm, and soon he was walking steadily with great purpose. Physically, the tunnels were also a balm. They had a never-changing, pleasant cool. In the deeper chambers, there was a hint of invigorating humidity. By the time they neared the wide mouth of the Ruberica, the party glowed with warp-born might. Rasselis felt invincible. He reminded himself that he was not, for nobody was. A false sense of power could undo their efforts of the next few hours, possibly damn them all. Rasselis ordered their veteran bodyguard to remain outside, and the party made their way within. The cave mouth was worked part way. Whoever had made the ancient tunnels had stopped their excavations when the glory of the Ruberica had become apparent to them, much as the space marines had ceased their excavations when they had encountered the labyrinth. Chisel marks of unfathomable antiquity still scored the wall. Rasselis traced them with his fingers until they suddenly stopped, and the space marines were in a tube of convoluted natural stone, untouched by any tool. It was volcanic in origin, there never having been enough water on Baal to create waves of hydrological process, but how exactly it had been formed was another mystery. The tunnel opened out into a wide, dark space. Mephiston was first into the Ruberica. Once he had passed into the room, it did not remain dark for long. Tendrils of psychic power wisped out from his head. Where they touched the cavern's sides, light kindled in the hearts of the giant crystalline formations encrusting every surface. Tall hexagonal pillars of pure bloodstone pointed towards the center of the chamber, as if the cave were a giant geode. On the floor, the crystals made an uneven but passable pavement that stepped up and down in pretty geometric blocks of translucent stone. As the other psychers came within the chamber, light grew, glowing from every surface, so that shortly the librarians moved through a world saturated in bloody light. Those space marines still wearing their helms removed them. Their skin was stained all the same shade, the whites of their eyes and enamel of their teeth, delicate pink in their ruddy faces. There were many strange things about the cavern. Among these was that the crystals healed themselves like a living, siliceous organism. The finest example of this was a servitor from an earlier millennium encased up to its waist in the floor. Crystals sprouted all over the rest of it, hiding its human form in immovable armor of ruby shards. Accidental nicks and cracks inflicted by the weight of space marine battleplate were always repaired the next time the cave was utilized by the Librarius for its rituals, but elsewhere the crystals did not grow and remained marked when damaged. Far from encouraging harvesting of the Ruberica, this strange phenomenon only increased the Librarius's veneration of the site. The floor rose up to a natural podium. Mephiston made for this place and stood upon it. He waited for the rest of the party to file in and take up their stations at lesser raised points of the floor until all the librarians were arrayed at different heights in a loose circle around him. Then did the Lord of Death speak.
I have told you all what we must accomplish here in this most sacred of places, and that it is dangerous and heretical, said Mephiston. Know that we have no choice. The demon known as Carbander has long coveted our souls. He is moving against us while we are at our most vulnerable.
Mephiston's voice had an unusual vigor, as of one who has recently fed upon warm blood. But the crystals absorbed the sound, preventing echoes, and so his speech was curiously flat.
"If he is not stopped, the consequences for our bloodline will be catastrophic," he continued. "All of us here wish that we could stand beside our brothers against the Xenos. What we do in this cave today is as important, if not more so. The Tyranids represent the gravest threat to the corpus of the Imperium, but Chaos, the ancient foe, is the greatest danger. It imperils the soul. If we are not successful here, our brothers will lose both life and spirit, but we will be successful. We shall bind the demon Carbander and abjure him, so preventing his ingress to this realm. Then we shall rejoin our chapters and scour the alien from this world with the power of the warp."
Mephisto nodded to Epistolary Marcello, designated the caller of the word for the ceremony. Rosellus took a deep breath. This whole enterprise had been dug out of an ancient book in Mephiston's personal collection. It stank of sorcery. The line between magic and the pure Emperor-sanctioned utilization of the warp was silk-thin and wavering. But this was no misjudgment. They were about to leap over the line with both feet.
"Begin," called Marcello. "Share the blood."
In major ceremonies at the Arks, blood thralls aided them. Chaplains stood by to guard the librarians against spiritual corruption. Sanguinary priests attended to protect the purity of the blood. There would be singing to calm the spirit and incense to cleanse the psychosphere. None of that was utilized. The librarians stood alone on the brink of damnation. Grimly, Rosellus twisted the release seal on his left gauntlet and pulled off the armored glove. He flexed his hand in the red light. His eyes met with a Lexicanium to his left. He did not know him beyond a psychic impression and a name on a scroll plate. Understanding passed between them. Rosellus offered up his wrist. The other bent his head to Rosellus's bared flesh and fastened his mouth around it. Rosellus gasped as the needle-sharp angel's teeth of the other pierced his skin. The librarian drank with increasing urgency.
"Enough," said Rosellus.
The other did not relent.
"Enough,"
he said firmly, and pulled his hand free. 3 drops of blood dripped from his wrist before his space marine physiology closed the wounds. The Lexicanium blinked and stepped woozily back, blood drunk. The warrior on the right offered up his wrist to Rosellus. The Codicia drank sparingly, ashamed and excited by the rising of the red thirst. The sharing done, the space marines replaced their gauntlets. Rosellus's wounds already itched with the formation of scar tissue. The deep ache of the wound in his flesh faded. The blood they had taken from one another did anything but fade. It warmed their stomachs and shortly thereafter sang in their veins. In each of the signs of Sanguinius was a tiny portion of the great angel's vitae, and to taste it afresh awakened their souls. Brotherhood bound them together more tightly than ever. With men he barely knew, Rosellus now had an intimate bond. At the center of it all stood Mephiston. He took no blood, but drank in the potency of the sharing nonetheless. He seemed to swell in size, becoming dark in countenance, shadows gathering around his back like flexing wings.
"Brothers,"
he said, and his voice was in their ears and in their minds, thick with stolen life,
"lend me your arts."
The ruby light flared, becoming not brighter, but more intense, taking on a consistency beyond that which light should possess. Mephiston's form wavered and grew. He was speaking words no servant of the Emperor should ever utter. A wound appeared before him, a slice in reality that dripped blood and tore like rent flesh. It split wide, and its edge bled fire and vitae. Through it, Rosellus saw terrible things. 2 armies of demons, one black, one red, battled upon a plain of bone. A gate of scarlet light in the shape of an angel opened from the demon's world into his own. There were stars on his side, and the curve of a red world with 2 moons encircled by warring fleets. Baal. He was looking at Baal. A titanic monstrosity was only yards from the gate, ape-faced and wide-horned. Blood-red skin strained with every swing of its axe as it fought its way through the last few beings barring its way. Hideous foes, almost as mighty as the creature, fell before its blade. From the demon emanated a terrible, all-encompassing fury that resounded from Rosellus's soul like the striking of a bell calling him to an eternity of war. Mephiston had opened a way into the realm of the Blood God. Heresy of the First Order. Worse by far, it spoke of a dark power in the chief librarian that exceeded that of all those who had come before him. Mephiston drew hard on the other librarians. Rosellus winced at the pain. The vital brotherhood between the psychers strained like a bulging net. Instinctively, Rosellus knew the bond joining them was all that prevented them from falling headfirst into the no places of the warp. The view changed, swooping down over the battle. Mephiston sprouted wings, blood-red and huge, traceries of fine veins visible through the stretched skin. His body was black as night, and eyes aglow. The view through the rip in space and time halted in the maw of the gate as the demon slew its last opponent. Carbander roared at the sky, and his followers screamed out their praises of him and fell in a frenzy on the last of the black-skinned demons, putting them to the sword and finally breaking them. Triumphantly, the angel's bane stepped towards the gate, ready to fall upon Baal. The Lord of Fury stopped. His triumph turned to puzzlement. He reached a hand to the gate to find his way barred. Snorting mists of blood from his nostrils, he peered downward and there spied Mephiston. He grunted a laugh, his angry face twisting with mirth. Heavy dreadlocks bound in brass rattled upon his breastplate. Yellow eyes shone with fiery delight. "What is this? Little angel, stop the gate. I have won the right to pass this way by blood and might. Begone. We shall see each other soon enough. I shall call for you, and you will join me." "Back," spoke Mephiston. The space between he and the demon shimmered with heat. "You cannot pass. The sons of the great angel do not permit it." Carbander snorted again. "You have no business here, Calistarius," he said mockingly. "Then how am I here?" shouted Mephiston back. "We abjure you. Depart from this gate by the will of the great angel." By way of answer, the demon threw back his head and howled with rage, so the ground shook and the sky rumbled with answering thunder. "Your broken-winged lord has no power over me," the demon snarled. "I am coming for your head, little Calistarius," he said, pointing his coiled whip at Mephiston. "Baal shall fall. The angels will see their true nature, and Khorne shall rejoice. Your legion is gathered after all this time. Such a fine harvest of warriors for the Blood God." He looked through the rift and spied the others in the cave. "All of you will fall to your knees, and gladly follow me before the eighth day of my manifestation is out." Carbander's yellow eye passed over Arcellus. His soul shivered. The demon's gaze provoked the rage in him. His mouth thirsted for blood, his soul for battle, and in his mind's eye unwelcome flashes of wars fought millennia before rose up to trouble him. His comrades were not so aged as he. Rosellus was steeped in the warp. Centuries of experience gave him a wisdom and resilience the others could not claim. The web binding the coven shuddered under Carbander's regard. Several of the company screamed with rage, but none fell. All stood firm. "My kind have resisted your temptation since the dawn of the Imperium," said Mephiston. "You will not best us. Begone from here. This is not your time."
"I will pass."
"Turn back!"
Carbander laughed in a savage, brutal mirth.
"Let the harvest be of blood rather than warriors. You may die rather than serve easily enough. Blood is its own reward. Khorne cares not whence it flows, only that it flows."
The beast swung his axe at Mephiston. Psychic energy blasted out where blade met man. Skulls, dislodged by the shockwave from the ground of Khorne's realm, flew in every direction and rang hollow musical notes as they rained down upon the sand and bone of the false earth. Within the cavern, the impact shivered out from Mephiston. Bonds, until now invisible, flared brightly, joining the breast of each librarian to his fellows with crackling arcs of power. Immaterial energies and the force of the blow together dissipated into the crystals, making the rock formations sing.
The mountain shook. The air shimmered with volcanic heat, and flaming cinders burst from the psychic web, but Mephiston did not fall. Carbander roared in outrage and cast his beady eye over the assembled librarians.
He who renounces his loyalty to the dead emperor shall be rewarded with immortal life. So swear I, most beloved of Khorne,
said Carbander. No one replied, but Rasselas felt through the heat and the rage a faint wavering.
Do you see, little Calistarius? They are tempted.
The last word became a grunt, and he hewed with his axe again at Mephiston. Warp made iron clashed with the dark radiance of Mephiston's soul. Power blasted into the material universe through the rift. A librarian of the Golden Suns died, his eyes bursting as flame consumed him from within. Rasselas was driven to his knees, and he cried out in agony. Again, that flicker of uncertainty. He looked out across the crystal cave, seeking out the weakness in the web.
Twice you have struck. Twice I remained unbowed, said Mephiston. Now it is my turn.
Mephiston drew Vitaris. The silver steel of the blade blazed with heat. Carbander swung again, and this time Mephiston met the blow with his own weapon. Reality moaned at the shock. Crystals sang and shattered. Fires burned in the very stone. The mountains shook upon its root, and the walls of the Ruberica cracked. Carbander was driven back, howling with anger. He recovered and ran at the rift, seeking to bypass Mephiston and force his way through to Baal. The weakness in the psychic web grew. Strands of power shriveled away, and Rasselas's gaze fell upon Antros. The librarian stood transfixed, and Rasselas knew in his heart that he was enchanted. His face was slack, and one hand was rising slowly to welcome the beast in.
Antros, concentrate! Let not the promises of the demon sway you!
Shouted Rasselas, quoting the Lexicanum's rule. Antros's perfect mouth moved, forming the words of a prayer.
For into evil a man shall fall, though evil he seek to avoid, if he once hearkens to the black tongue of the Neverborn,
he said along with Rasselas. Rasselas drew on strength he thought long exhausted, shoring up the weak point in the psychic web and lending his power to Mephiston. Carbander forced the gate. Mephiston swung with Vitaris, and the blade passed out of the rift into the realm of Khorne. Where it touched the leg of the Angel of Red Fire, the flames went out. The demons shrieked, and the portal slammed shut. But Carbander was not defeated. His head and one arm emerged into the crystal cave, swiping at the Lord of Death. He roared and bellowed, his shouts breaking crystals and bursting the eardrums of the Space Marines present. The librarians howled in agony, all of them. More died, but the stronger fought through the pain, and into Carbander's fiery breath they cast their spears of light and lances of blood, wounding the beast. Mephiston raised his sword again, sweeping it down. It was too late. The floor, sown by Antros's wavering, ruptured, and the librarians reeled as their fellowship broke. With a mighty heave, Carbander hauled himself through, breaking open the rift and gate both. He stood a moment in triumph, his roar shaking the mountain, until the wrath of Sanguinius, given form, blasted at him from every librarian, and he fell out of sight into a space between the worlds. The rift slammed shut. The mountain gave out a final tortured grinding, and there came into the chamber the rumble of falling stone as it shook. The librarians were staggered from their feet. Wild psychic energies lashed around the Ruberica. Crystals the size of land speeders crashed from their beds, crushing men under their weight, and the ruby light dimmed to blackness. Slowly, the shaking subsided. The mountain returned to equilibrium. The clatter of falling boulders outside the cavern came to a stop. Air moved and huffed around the cave as the bones of the earth ceased their pained grinding and settled into new configurations. Rasselas got to his feet slowly. His body was unharmed, but there was a deep, horrendous ache in his soul.
Mephiston!
He cried. Other voices spoke, calling to their brothers. Groans answered some, and others, silence. Fallen crystal crunched under Rasselas' feet as he made his way to the podium. Light returned, fitfully at first. More of his brothers had fallen than he had expected. They lay lifeless, blood leaking from their ears and nostrils. two were in a deadly embrace, hands locked about each other's throats. Others had clawed their own faces off in fits of rage, breaking open the skulls beneath. Blood was everywhere. The survivors were collecting themselves. All were shaken, no matter their might. Half were dead, the rest would never be the same again. Mephiston lived. He crouched upon the podium. The TARDIS was driven point down into the stone. He gripped its quillions as if they were the only things in the galaxy that could support him. His head was bowed, and his cloak pooled around him like broken wings.
"My lord," said Rasselas, "Mephiston!"
The look the Lord of Death gave Rasselas would haunt him until the end of his days.
"We failed. We were not strong enough. Carbander has come through into the world of men."
Rasselas nodded. It was as much as he had feared.
"Is he on Baal?"
Mephiston groaned and hauled himself up.
"No, I do not think so, but he will emerge close by. We should leave this place, warn Commander Dante, and perhaps we might make amends for our failure here through the slaughter of Xenos."
Rasselas looked behind him. The entrance to the cave was blocked by giant slabs of rock and crushed crystal.
"We have other concerns to address first, my lord. We must dig our way out, and that will take a long time."
He returned his eyes to Mephiston.
"I fear the battle for Baal is finished for us."
Chapter 20, At the Third Line.
"D-d-da,"
stammered the boy. Luigi stirred out of a half-sleep, haunted by screaming monsters. When he remembered where he was eager to get back to his nightmare.
"What?"
he said. They were out beyond the wall, stuck behind the feeble defense line in the face of the Tyranids and the frigid desert night. The moon shone blandly in a sky crowded with alien horrors. The guns had never stopped, not once, and the shields of the Angel's home guttered unnatural flame in response to the living bombardment. Horrible shrieks sounded in the desert, the sound of tortured artillery screaming as it fired. On the far side of the moat, blood-chilling screeches and cries haunted the night. But no assault came. He felt intolerably heavy and wearied beyond comprehension.
"Why are we waiting here? It's cold. I'm scared. Why did they make us come back?"
The boy was all a twitch, shoulders rising and rotating with a will of their own. It was always that way when he was scared. His son, lost to him now, would never have asked such stupid questions, but would have astounded Luigi with his insights. Nor would he have writhed so piteously. Luigi missed his son, and had no time for the boy's whimpering.
"We're the meat in the trap," he said viciously. "We're here, in front of their vile Xenos noses, right where they can smell us. They want to eat us, don't you see? We're softer meat than the angels in their armor."
"Stop it, Dar. Stop it. You're scaring me."
The boy clamped his fists over his ears and began to rock on his haunches. Luigi gave him a look of disgust and spat. His mouth tasted of battle smoke and Xenos fluids. He wiped his arm across his mouth. A ghostly white face loomed out of the darkness. Luigi's stomach spasmed at the sight. An angel in black, with a skull for a helmet, stared down at them. He towered over the defense line's crenellations, but seemed to have no fear of the enemy picking him off.
"What is this noise?" the angel said, with a voice as deep as the night.
For a moment, Luigi thought it was the warrior priest he had encountered in Angel's Fall before all this began, when they were ignorant of the coming threat. Then he realized his armor was styled differently, and his voice was sterner. He tried to tell himself there was a man inside the power armor, but his mind would not accept it. Luigi cursed the attention the warrior priests were paying him of late. Luigi threw himself down, tugging the boy after him to grovel at the angel's feet.
"I'm sorry, my lord. Forgive us."
Luigi's face pressed into the sand. It was strangely scented. Baal was so alien to him.
"Our creed teaches us that only we can forgive ourselves. Hold your silence, or you will hurry your death. Do you wish that?" "I'm sorry, my lord. The boy is frightened."
The angel's breathing rasped from his augmeter. Luigi risked a glance upwards. The angel was a mountain of black armor lit by fire and void shield light, topped with a skull like a forbidding shrine, in whose sockets fires glowed.
Back to your post, said the warrior. It is normal for your kind to know fear. Trust in the great angel, aim truly, and all will be well. Luigi dragged himself back up. The angel watched him curiously. I cannot move my arms and legs as I would, said Luigi, explaining his sluggish reaction. This weapon weighs as much as an anvil. We cannot run. This accursed weight. Baal is a place for angels. We sin by being here. You are not cursed. It is only the world. The mass of this planet is higher than of the moon's. It is gravity that afflicts you, not a curse, said the angel. The boy, for all his idiocy, was quicker than Luigi, and was already back at the firing slit.
My lord, said the boy.
Silence, hissed Luigi. Let him speak, growled the angel. What is it?
There is something out there, he said.
The boy pointed out into the dark. Luigi squinted, but could see nothing amid the shattered corpses of the enemy on the far shore. The first water glinted with a light of reflected fire. The angel swung his head around and looked out.
Where?
He said. The boy pointed. As the boy raised his finger, a beast plummeted, shrieking from the sky, splashing into the first water with wings folded. Another followed, then another.
Movement on the far bank, said the space marine.
Luigi did not have the advantage of space marine eyes, and saw nothing beyond the pale, streaking shapes of creatures raining out of the sky. The angel said something to his brothers via his armor's devices. A ripple of guns sounded from the home of the angels, and the sky was filled with slowly falling stars that flooded the desert with harsh light. Then Luigi saw. A living carpet of gaunts crept towards the moat on their bellies, smaller beasts the size of rats moving stealthily among them.
They are attempting to cross! Open fire! Shouted Ordermail.
Guns spoke all down the line, the cracking reports of thousands of lasguns intermingled with the isolated flat bangs of bolters. The flares prompted a reaction. All at once, thousands of winged creatures began to throw themselves from the sky into the moat, screeching as they fell, and were consumed. And on the far side, the slinking aliens rose up and rushed forward as one. The guns on the curtain wall opened up on the horde. War's pandemonium was unleashed once more. Ordermail received a flurry of data squirts from various places. The Strategium, the Citadel Reclusium, the company commanders overseeing the section of the curtain wall behind him. The Tyranids were attacking at five distinct points. The aerial swarm was hurling itself into the moat across spaces no more than 50 feet wide. The terrestrial creatures approached the same segments.
They mean to fill the moat with their dead, he told the mortals. Teach them the error of their ways.
All sections prepare for immediate armored support,
voxed a voice he did not know. A data tag signified it as coming from the Strategium.
Stand by for heavy artillery bombardment.
The Tyranids were wily. Broods of lesser gaunts raced up and down the bank, drawing much of the fire of the human conscripts.
Concentrate fire on the crossing point!
Ordermail bellowed over the whistle of shells and explosions that obliterated thousands of creatures on the far side. An incandescent stream of plasma turned night into day, charring the falling aerial creatures into carbon at the edges of its track, evaporating them completely at the heart. The humans cried out as their unprotected eyes were damaged. Ordermail sensorium pinged out warning notes, the eye lenses darkened to compensate. When the stream cut out and his lenses cleared, he was blinking away after images. Still, the creatures came. The aerial swarm was so thick that fell in an almost solid torrent, obscuring the creatures charging into the water from the far side. As during the day, thousands of Tyranids died. Heavy weapons cut the dropping creatures to pieces. Titan killers punched massive holes in the swarm. It was to no avail. Slowly but surely, the moat was filling with corpses. The bones of Tyranid dead rose to the surface as more and more creatures poured themselves into the moat. Even as the bone causeway broke the surface of the hungry water, they continued to die. A splash from the moat was a death sentence. Convulsing gaunts spilled from the sides of the causeway, widening it. It rose higher from the water until its snout was proud of the killing liquid. The gaunts poured on, those strains armed with ranged weapons not even bothering to discharge them, as they threw themselves to their death. The rain of aerial creatures continued. A huge splash exploded upward as a larger flying beast crashed into the water right at the edge of the extending rampart. It took its time in dying, thrashing about and spraying deadly liquid all over the creatures rushing to use it as a bridge. Hundreds more fell to the concentrated fire of the Space Marines. Their deaths were of no account, only their mass was. Whether its minions fell whole or in pieces into the moat was irrelevant to the hive mind, so long as they fell.
"Keep firing!" shouted Ordermail. "We stand in the eye of the storm! The Emperor is immobile upon his golden throne. He relies on you for victory, your strength, your will. Do not disappoint him."
His words were drowned out by the terrible racket of the swarm. Being close to so many of them affected the mind. His thoughts were filled with nameless dread. Ordermail was not one to be frightened. He pushed aside the artificial fear, contemptuously held up his gun, and strode forward beyond the defense line, sending bolts winging their way into the horde. Seeing the Angel of Death stand unharmed before the fury of the enemy heartened the mortal troops, and their fire rate increased. They could not miss. Every lasbeam felled an alien. It did not matter. The lead edge of the causeway approached the Imperial side with increasing speed, the aliens building upon the now firm foundations of their own dead. Screeching Hormagaunts sprang forward from the advancing lip. Several floundered in the water close to the edge, long claws stabbing into the bank to haul themselves out, as they were devoured alive. The next group would make the jump.
"Concentrate upon the lead elements!"
Ordermail shouted. Support fire from the curtain wall switched targets, homing in on the causeways themselves. The bone bridges were hit several times, but every crater was rapidly filled, and the causeways grew wider, pushing out the first water. Free of its rock-reed channel and sated with the moisture of a million alien dead, it seeped away into the sand. Xenos' hooves and claws clicked on dry bone. Gunfire scythed the Tyranids down. They came on, still. The first over were 100 leaping Hormagaunts. They bounded high over the last dozen feet of the first water and landed on the near side of the moat. Ordermail blasted 3-0 as they galloped the short distance to the defense line. Lasbeams cracked through the air, but the creatures were too fast for the mortals to easily hit. They were almost too quick for Ordermail. 3 rapidly aimed shots took down 2 more, and then they were on him.
"By the blood am I strong! By the blood do I serve!"
He swung his Crozius, obliterating a gaunt. Disruption lightning chased itself up his arms and earthed itself in the ground. He blew the head off another gaunt. A third he kicked as it leapt at him, pulverizing its ribcage with his boot and destroying its organs. But there were too many, far too many. Tank engines roared. Armored vehicles cut up a 100-yard gap between the defense line and curtain wall. The void shield rippled as they passed through and opened fire. Their heavy weapons mowed down hundreds of the beasts in a moment, slowing the Tyranids' screaming assault over the bone causeway. They were too late to save the mortals. The humans were dying, engaged at close range by creatures designed only to kill. The gaunt's faces were wrinkled as if in hate.
"Do they hate us?" wondered Ordermail. "Do they know emotion at all?"
He paused, torn between running to the front to fight with the tanks and saving the humans who had fought under his command these last days.
"It is a Blood Angel's duty to protect," he said to himself. "They have served their purpose. We use them callously. I shall not abandon them now their role is played."
Ordermail ran back towards the defense line, bolter firing. He gunned down 2 of the creatures. Bolt shrapnel from the gaunt's deaths slew 1 of the mortals. Unavoidable. The others lived for his efforts. He vaulted the wall, gun still firing. The mortals were in disarray. Many were lying on the floor in terror, though some fought as well as they could. He banished his awareness of the blood upon the sand from his mind, though his treacherous body responded eagerly to the smell. His bolt pistol emptied. He ejected his magazine and loaded a fresh one as he scanned the ground between the third and second lines. There were few Tyranids in the killing field. The lines of tanks were holding back the Xenos. This was as good a chance as the mortals were going to get.
"This line is lost. You have done your part here. Retreat. The Emperor watch over you. Take your weapons. Fall back to the wall."
For the final time, the mortals turned from the defense line and ran. Automail watched them go. They struggled to run in Baal's iron grip, but enough passed through the void shield, leaving man-sized ripples. What few Tyranids moved to intercept them were shot by space marines on the curtain wall. There were only a fraction of the mortals left, but these ones at least would live. A demolisher cannon boomed close to the moat. The vindicator it was mounted upon rocked back on its suspension by the discharge. Ordermail moved forward, intending to pick off the few creatures that got close enough to the armor to pose a threat. But as he ran, the vindicator exploded violently, throwing Ordermail from his feet. A mighty roaring followed its demise. He lifted his head up, groggy from the explosion. Dozens of heavy assault beasts were crossing the bridge. A quick glance at his cartilith showed him the situation was the same at four of the five other crossings the Tyranids had attempted. The tanks reversed, those with turrets tracking round to better target the approaching beasts. Two huge things that scuttled like arachnids unleashed living rounds from their massive symbiotic cannons. Bloated pods ruptured on the hulls of the tanks, covering them in oily fluids. Hurtling seeds followed from the cannon's second barrels, reacting with the oils on the metal. The hollow thumps of implosion turned two tanks inside out. Then, from the walls, came a bloodthirsty howling, and Ordermail knew from that sound how grave the situation had become. Luigi and the boy were staggering through a vision of hell. Their leaden bodies refused to obey. They ran with horrifying slowness through the advancing space marine tanks. Flat-sided vehicles in various reds and blacks rumbled past them. They had their attention on the enemy, and any mortal who inadvertently got in the way was crushed flat under their grinding treads. The enemy intensified their screaming bombardment. Gobbets of liquid became explosive conflagrations when they hit the ground, saturating wide areas of the killing zone outside the void shield with chemical fires. The tanks shrugged off these deadly falls, but any human caught by them was immolated immediately. An acid gas wafted over the battlefield, choking those who breathed it in, growing thicker by the second. The boy was gibbering with fright, but he went on, dragging at his father's unwilling arm. Luigi panted with the effort of running under such weight. The boy shoved him back as a fleshy ball, hung with tentacles on its underside, fell from the sky and exploded near a tank, spattering it with corrosive liquid. The nature of the swarm's noise behind them changed, becoming deeper, issuing from a few throats rather than many. Luigi risked a terrified look back and saw the swaying spore chimneys of monsters coming through the smoke, gas, and flames. He moaned in fear, his muscles turned to water, and he stumbled. But the boy dragged him on. The curtain wall of the second line rose ahead, its features rendered indistinct by the wavering shield. Fiery liquids slapped into the energy field and vanished in painful light. Explosive spore munitions detonated violently, leaving only ripples on the air. The boy wept, but pulled Luigi on, some part of his damaged mind remembering the brave youth he had been. A wall of violet rose up, curved, and seemingly as delicate as a soap bubble, and yet it was proof against all violence. Luigi gritted his teeth. He did not enjoy passing through the void shield. Luigi and the boy plunged through. As its protective energies shielded his body, great pain ripped through his soul, as if he gave up a part of what he was in exchange for survival. Something in a place beyond the blackest night howled for his immortal spirit. Then they were through, and the din of battle was blunted. Other mortals burst through the skin of energy in a straggling line. The curtain wall was before them, ancient, time-pitted rockcrete contrasted with the darker greys of freshly constructed parapets. Plasteel cupolas, housing heavy bolters and las cannons, protruded from the wall, while in the crenellations' embrasures, the hulking forms of heavily armed space marines crouched, their missile launchers and plasma cannons sending out a torrent of fire at the enemy. A small gate beckoned. Luigi staggered on, the boy dragging him when his own legs would not obey him. Safety was near, yet the night was not yet done with its terrors. Terrifying howls split the darkness, this time coming from ahead. A deafening scream of multiple jet engines blotted out all other noise. Space marines in black came leaping over the parapets, jump packs flaring bright in the dark. They shouted incoherently as they fell towards the ground. Their movements were frenzied, seemingly out of their control. They dropped all around the boy and Luigi. Seeing the mortals there, one raised an axe, crackling with angelic power.
"Death to the traitors! Death to Horus!"
he shouted. There came a mighty clash of metal on metal, the boom of angels' weapons meeting. A priest of the angels stayed the axe with the winged head of his own staff, the two weapons sparking angrily at the contact.
"To the front! The enemy are not here! These are blameless civilians, caught in the perfidy of the traitors! Let them pass! Let them pass!"
And then the black-clad space marines were running on, shouting and roaring, and the chaplain was with them at the fore, leaving Luigi and the boy alone. They staggered on towards the gate, other bar lights with them, scattering when a boxy transport painted black with red crosses burst through, engine roaring as furiously as the warriors whose livery it shared. Luigi fell down in terror. The tracks missed him by inches, spraying up sand into his face as it sped by, another following, then another. He lay weeping on the holy sand of Baal, as ashamed at his cowardice as he was terrified. A hand tugged at his limp arm.
"Da, it's safe now. They've all gone."
Luigi raised his head slowly from the dirt. Space marines in red were coming out from the gate, helping up the few mortals who had made it back to the wall. One ran at him, and Luigi expected the end, but a ceramite gauntlet grabbed his arm, encircling his bicep with room to spare, and hauled him painfully to his feet. A voxmeter clicked.
"You are safe, Barlite," he said. "You have survived."
The survivors were rounded up and herded within the wall, space marines making a watchful perimeter around them. The gate slammed shut behind. It was as if Luigi had stepped through into another world. Battle became a rumor of distant gunfire and beastly shrieks. Transports cut across the wide landing fields between the fortress and the wall in neat formation. Space marines ran in well-ordered squads from one area to another. The mortals dropped, exhausted, near the gate, ignored by the warriors they'd nearly died for. The void shield sparkled hundreds of feet overhead. Fire raged in the night skies. Baal Primus was a watery circle on the other side of the shield's shifting energies, its face twinkling with the fires of war. Within the wall, it was much calmer. But Luigi could never feel safe. The boy took his hand and leaned into Luigi's shoulder. Luigi was too exhausted to object. The Death Company came like furies into the fight, leaping over the line of tanks holding back the Tyranids with savage abandon. Their plasma pistols spat bright suns of deadly energy into the foe. A squad hurtled past order mail, raging, shouting at traitors that were not present. At the urging of their chaplain, they singled out a Tyrannophex that had destroyed four tanks, and they fell on it wildly. One boosted himself directly at its face, Thunderhammer swinging round as he flew. The blow destroyed half the creature's skull, but it did not fall until another Death Company space marine ran howling at its side, punched his power fist through its chest, and wrenched out a lumpen organ. Screaming out his hatred of the traitor legions, the space marine closed his fist, annihilating the alien heart in his hand. The Tyrannophex fell forward, dead. That there were many more enormous assault beasts behind it, and they shouldered their broodmate aside into the moat and pressed on, symbiotic guns convulsing and spraying potent acids and bullet grubs over everything. The Death Company were legion, hundreds strong. Order mail was equally uplifted and saddened to see so many. Giving them their blessing had been an honor. This was the curse of their blood, unleashed in full. So many Death Company space marines fought around order mail that it was as if there were a chapter of them. In their warring, he saw a glimpse of the bloodline's future. Order mail followed in their wake. Upon the causeway of dead Tyranids, the enemy were being pushed back by the combination of heavy tank fire and the Death Company's relentless assault. Order mail thought to direct them, but there was no need. Now they were among the Tyranids, they fought like demons, tearing apart the alien beasts. The gaunt hordes of earlier had given way to great crowds of the warrior strain. Given their numbers, it was no surprise how well coordinated the alien assault was. Waves of heavier creatures marched forward, sheltering the warrior broods with their bulk and thick armor. Shells energy bolts and flaming chemicals showered down on the battlefield from all sides. Truly, this was a vision of the mythical inferno. Into the maelstrom strode Ordermail. He ignored the larger beasts, saving his efforts for those creatures that could be harmed by his weapons. He dropped Tyranid warriors with single shots to the eye and smashed limbs with his Crozius. The Death Company penetrated deeply into the masses of Tyranids. They fought on with the most horrendous injuries. Ordermail saw one still on his feet with the front of his helmet and all the flesh beneath melted down to the bone. But they were not immortal. One by one, they fell to the talons, claws, and pincers of the monsters attacking the home of the Blood Angels. Ordermail sorrowed to see so many of his bloodkin die. It was impossible to tell who hailed from which chapter. In the end, they stood together, one blood in death. It was how it should be, he thought. A lone warrior strain came at him from the night, bone swords swinging for his head. Ordermail met them with his Crozius, parrying them with minimal movements. The warrior held a bag-like weapon symbiote in its lower limbs, tipped with a bony funnel. A death spitter. Ordermail filled it with a burst of three bolts, rupturing the ammunition sack and sending writhing grubs in a cascade to the ground. The warrior screamed as if it had been hurt itself, and pressed its attack with its twinned swords. Yellow, split-pupilled eyes rolled in the hilts of each weapon. The blades were white and pink, like fresh bone. In every way, the creature was repugnant. Ordermail put it down with a blow to the head that cracked its tall crest in twain. A wide-band vox message echoed in his helmet. All warriors retreat to the curtain wall. The third line has fallen. Prepare for wall assault. Hold the second line. Reluctantly, Ordermail withdrew, leaving the bloated multi-chapter Death Company to sell their blood, lives, and gene seed in one last glorious act of violence. Chapter 21. Death of the Future. The Lictor lay still as its kin beasts plummeted down from orbit. It did not move as they swept over its hiding space. It watched as the hive was repulsed from the third line and was watching still when it fell. It bore silent witness to the slaughter at the moat. As shells rained around it, it betrayed no movement. Until finally, opportunity presented itself. The Lictor dug itself out of its hiding space, silently. It kept low, hugging the slip faces of the dunes around the arcs, never once exposing itself. As the pandemonium of war raged around it, the chances of detection were infinitesimal, but the hive mind took no chances. The Lictor scuttled through the fields of wrecked tanks. It hid, a space marine skycraft screamed overhead. At any chance of detection, it froze, reducing its biological activity to the absolute minimum until the danger passed. The route it took was erratic, its destination concealed by wide detours and backtracking. It looked as if it were hunting for something. In reality, it knew exactly where it was going. Behind the wall of Tyranids, moving up to attack the second line, it was strangely quiet. Away from the fortress, eater beasts were landing, and the tools of digestion being deployed. But Baal was minimally gifted with life, and the density of the digestion swarm was low. The battle swarm's noise shushed and roared, its hissing, clacking voice punctuated by the repetitive banging of the prey's weaponry. Some of their devices were impressively destructive, much more so than the weapon creatures employed by the swarm, but the efficacy of individual guns was irrelevant. The hive mind had a billion for every one employed by the prey. Its weapons were not dependent on chains of supply or minerals mined on faraway worlds. They required no specialist worker caste to create. Everything the hive mind needed, it grew within itself. And the prey always ran out of bullets before the hive mind ran out of bodies. Still, certain prey required care, hence the Lictor's mission. The hive mind's cell bodies were numerous but not infinite. There was an optimal ratio of destroyed beasts to biomass harvested. Exceed it, and the consumption of a world would result in a net loss. Warrior creatures were dispensable, but the larger ships and complicated beasts cost time and organic matter to replace. If there was a way to shorten a war, the hive mind would find it. The Lictor reached its destination. sophisticated organic senses, equal to any machine the Imperium could employ, probed the ground, ensuring this was the correct spot. For days, the Lictor had been gathering intelligence on the surroundings of the Arx Angelicum. Its specialized brain acted as a node, gathering together sensory data from a million other creatures. They had no awareness of what they were seeing. They had no need for the data they unwillingly collected. That was the Lictor's role. Under the sands was an anomaly. Once, a tunnel had led out of the Arx Angelicum to a fuel tank. The tank had been removed millennia ago. The tunnel had been collapsed and forgotten. The hive mind, working through the Lictor, knew none of this, and would not have comprehended the information if it had. It saw a weakness. It needed to know more. The Lictor's hyper-enlarged brain pulsed magnetic waves through the sand, picking out chunks of crushed rockcrete and the outline of the tunnel's route towards the Arx Angelicum's walls. The fortress was so close. Its multiple eyes could enlarge the structure so much at this close range it could see every finial and carving. If it turned its attention to the seething bone and purple sea of the war swarm, they appeared close enough to touch. Naturally, these were more human concepts than were alien to the hive mind. The Lictor did not regard itself apart from its brethren. It did not regard itself at all. A blurred map of the underground shimmered in its magnetic sight. It plunged its head into the ground, the tentacles that made up its mouth writhing through the sand, and it tasted trace amounts of complex hydrocarbons and minerals that were not native to this prey world. Longer-range sonar surroundings displayed the path of the tunnel nearly all the way to the wall. The sand was reefed with broken artificial stone. The point in the mountain where the tunnel had penetrated was smooth, capped with more false rock and refined metallic minerals. It was strong, but not as strong as the natural glassy stone of the dead volcano. The Lictor rose suddenly. It emitted a short burst of aromatic chemicals and a weak psychic pulse. Both were beneath the prey's notice, but its fellow creatures heard. Like white blood cells are attracted to sites of infection, soon creatures joined the Lictor. They needed no direction. A pair of suitable beasts swam through the sand and began excavating a new tunnel alongside the path of the old. They were known to the Imperium as Trigons, something else the hive mind did not care to know. It had no names for its constituent parts. The wolf cares nothing for the thoughts of sheep. They worked quickly, shoving the sand aside with their claws and compacting it. There would be no spoil heaps to give them away. Resinous secretions from their long bodies sealed the sand into a form of organic concrete. Soon, others came.